Welcome. I think you're both familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that it's important that you say your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument so that our record is clear. You will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may adjust the podium to suit your needs. It can go up or I think it's down as far as it can go, but it can go up if that is useful to you. And when you are ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Ann Tressler, T-R-E-S-S-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Marcus Shante Pope. The primary issue we'd like to raise on appeal before the court today is the determination of awarding joint legal and physical custody in this matter, despite the fact that there were two neutral custody evaluations performed, which had recommendations to the contrary. We also address in our appeal the issue of parenting time and child support. We hope that those are well briefed for the court's consideration, as I believe the legal and physical custody are the primary issues today. A brief background on the facts. The parties in this case, this was a short marriage. The parties were married on September 28th of 2012. Their daughter was born December 18th of 2013. The proceeding began when the petition was signed in January of 2016. So this has gone on for quite a while. The child was two at the time the proceeding began. She is currently now five, scheduled to go into kindergarten in the fall. The appellant petitioned originally for sole legal and physical custody. The respondent originally filed her answer and counterpetition for joint legal and physical custody, but one day later amended to sole legal and physical custody and held that petition for approximately 18 months during both custody evaluations and until trial. During trial, she testified that she was asking for joint legal and joint physical. Her answer and counterpetition were not amended, and no leave was requested from the court to do so.
Why is that significant, Ms. Tressler?
I believe it's just is appropriate for the record that the original filing, and as the evaluations were being done, which she was obviously not happy with the results, she stood on the position of sole legal and physical. And after two neutral evaluations came back recommending sole legal and sole physical to my client, during testimony, she suddenly changed her position to joint legal and joint physical, which also falls under our new best interest standards under paragraph B, where there is the argument that short of domestic abuse, if one party is asking for joint legal custody, the presumption has to fall that way. So I believe there was some potentially tactical issues based on how the results of the evaluations came out. During this entire proceeding, which obviously has been going on for quite some time, during the entire process, the parties at no time agreed upon a parenting schedule. The parties originally retained Judy Sherwood as the first neutral evaluator. That evaluation was completed in July of 28th of 2016. Again, that recommended sole legal and physical custody to my client. It allowed the respondent essentially statutory minimum parenting time. It was about 28%. The statutory minimum is 25%.
Ms. Tressler, I agree with you that the fact that both evaluators were in favor of your client, you know, is telling. But it seemed to me the district court went into great detail as to why it was rejecting them and made specific credibility determinations. So I guess I don't understand why, given that explanation and given our standard review, we would not accept that as to why it rejected the fact that both evaluators, you know, favored sole legal custody.
Well, that actually goes into other aspects that I was going to start going into. It is our position, and as we briefed, we believe that the district court actually misrepresented facts when you look at the findings of fact. We can go into some simple examples. When the court decided to disregard Ms. Judy Sherwood's evaluation, that was the first one that was completed, the court relied on a couple of things. One was Dr. Peterson had done the psychological testing in this matter. When Mindy Mitnick came on and she reviewed that information, she had not reviewed Ms. Sherwood's evaluation, but she looked at what Dr. Peterson had done. She was concerned that some of it was done incorrectly. There was a specific test, I believe it was the MMPI, It should have been scored by a computer. It was done by hand.
Yep.
And she was unable to, obviously, confirm that that was accurate. The findings in the order indicate that the court chose to disregard Judy Sherwood's not only basically because Dr. Peterson's testing was incorrect. Mindy Mitnick didn't say that. She said she couldn't verify whether it was correct or not, and I think that's a very important point. Additionally, when Judy Sherwood testified, she also testified to the fact that that the testing by Dr. Peterson was, as she put it, quote, one piece of the puzzle. There was multiple other things that went into the evaluation that she performed. There were hours that were spent with both parties, with the child, and it was a thorough evaluation. So I believe disregarding it for that one factor is important. But
the district court also made a credibility finding, namely that the district court believed Mindy Mitnick's testimony that, you know, I was so concerned about this, I actually called Ms. Sherwood and said, you know, something along the lines of, I don't know that I'd use that person again. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, Ms. Sherwood either said it didn't happen or didn't remember it. But, I mean, it seems to me the district court's findings of fact with respect to the testimony of the two experts was a little bit more than just saying, I'm not accepting this because you did your MMPI on paper instead of by computer.
Right. Well, and actually kind of that jumps to the Mindy Mitnick, not only her testimony, but her evaluation. And to your point, the court found her credible. And in regards to that, the court also didn't give consideration to, at least in the findings of fact, there is nothing that indicates that she addresses the detail of the rest of Ms. Mitnick's evaluation. And Ms. Mitnick's evaluation goes into other concerns. Ms. Mitnick talked about her concern about the credibility of the respondent when she was going through the evaluation. The court indicated that they found the respondent credible on the stand, but yet doesn't go back to look at where Mindy Mitnick's concerns were. It just, the findings, although she went through every single factor, the court went through every single factor in the findings, but if you go into the detail of those findings, she really doesn't address why she didn't give the Mindy Mitnick's evaluation proper weight. She really doesn't address it at all. She says she reviewed it, but then never says why. She doesn't give it consideration. And again, the factor in regards to Ms. Sherwood's, there was the position that this was all because of Dr. Peterson. There was a concern. And again, Mindy Mitnick did testify that she called Judy Sherwood. She was also concerned because one aspect of the test, apparently he was on the original version, there is now a fourth version, but even Mindy Mitnick said that after reviewing Dr. Peterson's psychological testing, she used some of it. She used what she was sure was accurate, disregarded the one section that was the original form, and then the one that was left into question, she did not use that. But she did use some of it. And again, whether you're looking at Judy Sherwood's or Ms. Mitnick's, there was far more detail that went into these evaluations that are not reflective in the findings.
Is there a requirement that a district court make findings about every aspect of a witness's testimony or of an expert witness's testimony or recommendations?
Well, the court is required if they're going to contradict an evaluation, they need to go into specific details as to why.
And why is it seems to me the court made pretty careful findings about why it was accepting some parts of the recommendation and how it was looking at mother's more recent conduct. I mean, part of the Sherwood was 18 months or at least before the time of trial. So there are things that had changed between the parties during that interim. I mean, I'm having a hard time being persuaded that the district court didn't consider the evidence thoroughly or explain its findings.
Well, Your Honor, actually, in preparing for today, one of the things, because I felt that there were multiple points that were important in regards to where I felt the findings of fact were not consistent with the evidence as presented, I basically made a very brief outline of them. First of all, the part of the court's findings, and it'll digress to the issue of parenting time, but the issue of alienation was brought up in regards to legal custody, and that's one of the specific factors that's changed under the best interest test. Whether or not having one parent have sole authority over the other and whether or not that would be a detriment to the child is no longer a consideration. Alienation can certainly be understood and understandable that it's looked at in regards to parenting time, because whether or not a parent has appropriate parenting time can, in fact, impact whether or not there could be alienation. However, if the court is using alienation in this particular case, then we're really at a point where we're basically throwing out a statutory minimum of parenting time. Because if this court believes that if mom only has a statutory minimum of parenting time and that'll create alienation, we've got a problem with an awful lot of cases out there and the fact that our statute has a statutory minimum. That presumes that basically every case should have almost an equal schedule. So that's concerning.
Doesn't alienation go beyond just the amount of time, and it has to do with how whether one parent is bad-mouthing the other or undermining the relationship between the child and that other parent?
Well, at this point, one of the things that Mindy Mitnick testified to was how much the child would have understanding of because of her age, and obviously that would change with time. So to your point, that could certainly be considered. We see that in our cases all the time. I'm sure counsel also sees that where people are coming back because those issues are coming up. But we're looking at the case as it is that day. And to say that sole legal custody would create alienation, that's problematic right there. To say that mom only having a statutory minimum, and again, it's slightly more than statutory minimum was recommended, is also going to create alienation. Again, it creates a question for our law. And there's been an awful lot of experts and thought and legislative intent behind the law as it exists today. There were several other things. The court, under finding of fact 19, stated that by the time Mindy Mitnick's evaluation was done, father's residency was primary because father refused requested parenting time and cited text messages that are exhibits 110 between 123. First of all, there was an error there because all these text messages actually predated Mindy Mitnick's evaluation. There was also a finding of fact that referred to two instances where dad kind of allegedly interfered with mom's parenting time. And it was these two lunches at the daycare. One was Thanksgiving, one was Christmas. When the appellant was on the stand, he owned accountability for the Thanksgiving one. He's like, this has been stressful, I didn't handle this well. The Christmas one was a misunderstanding. If you read the text messages, the issue of this Christmas lunch never even came up when the two were trying to coordinate when mom would pick up the daughter until the very last text message. So it was misrepresented to the court, and it was testified to incorrectly by respondent that this was somehow a second attempt to interfere with her having a lunch with the child, because as they finally finalized the pickup time, that was when she mentioned that the lunch was at issue. The court also, as I indicated, I believe the court did in fact not give proper weight to the evaluation. The court ordered that the evaluations would be deemed direct testimony, and because of that, it appears that the findings should have supported more specifics of what was recommended by Mindy Mitnick, what was recommended by Judy Sherwood, and why those were not being followed, because that also limited what testimony could be taken in the courtroom. There's also, one of the cases we cited was the Weatherly case, and in that particular case, I believe it was your court, found that negative testimony about the dad in that case was not given any consideration when you looked at the findings. In this particular case, there were a lot of concerns about mom in Mindy Mitnick's evaluation, in Judy Sherwood's evaluation, that are not given any weight or consideration when you review the findings and the record in this case. If the evaluations are direct testimony, there should have been reasons why those were not given more consideration in determining what was truly in the child's best interest.
Well, I mean, there are findings with respect to mother's parenting challenges and the, aren't there? I mean, but there are also findings about what she was doing to address her deficiencies.
Right, and
why isn't that sufficient to indicate to the parties and to permit us to review the question of whether the district court appropriately considered all the evidence?
Well, again, there was other information in the evaluation that's not given being considered. And when the court talked about what mom was doing, and nobody, I hope no one, including myself as a mother, would ever minimize when a mom's trying to be better. That's fantastic. But one of the things Mindy recommended with a parenting coach was that not only she have a parenting coach, but the parenting coach give real-time feedback. And when the parenting coach testified to the fact that she would meet and kind of observe mom with their daughter, and then there'd be feedback 3 or 4 days later. It was specifically what Mindy Mitnick was actually discouraging because of the productivity of it. I realize as my time is wrapping up again, I'm hopeful that the brief is sufficient. And again, we believe that there was clearly an abuse of discretion here. The facts do not support how the findings of fact were concluded or the final outcome of determination of joint legal and joint physical custody. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Carla Shellberg, spelled K-J-E-L-L-B-E-R-G. I represent the respondent, Angela Pope. The level of review or the standard of review here, as the court knows, is one of discretion to the lower court. And the only question is, are the findings supported by the evidence? And it's even more when you are, as the court in Vagnus said, that this court, the law leaves scant room to reevaluate the best interest standards. And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is in the evaluation of the best interest standards, what's most important are two things. One, credibility. Two, the complete weighing and totality of the information.
But here we have a situation where you have not one but two professional custody evaluators making the same recommendation at different points in time based on similar but some additional information as well, and a district court that doesn't, that especially says one of the two evaluators is credible and experienced and
correct,
and yet disregard it. Shouldn't that have been enough to rebut the presumption of joint custody?
Your Honor, I don't think so. And I think if you look in the factual findings and you look at the record, it's very clear what happened. That the first custody evaluation, excuse me, Your Honor, as the court stated, Judy Sherwood relied too heavily on the psychological evaluation. And she even quotes it in the end of her report. I don't remember it completely, but basically what she said is, as Dr. Peterson's findings show, Ms. Pope cannot learn from her mistakes. That's basically what she said. So then you go to the second evaluation with Ms. Mitnick, who is probably one of the most trusted evaluators in this state. She says the testing was inappropriate because you don't know if that specific conclusion was correct because he did not score it by machine. He scored it by hand. She was so concerned, and this never happens. She was so concerned she called Judy Sherwood. All right, so what does she find when she does her own evaluation? Number one, she finds, and this is, I've cited it in the brief, she finds that there is no psychological problem, or how did she put it, psychological determination that would affect custody. For example, my client doesn't have those things that Dr. Peterson said she did. And secondly, she said, this is an issue of parenting skills. And I quoted her exact testimony both from the trial and I believe I referenced the deposition. They're both identical. So is what you're saying that my client, that your recommendation is based upon the fact that Mr. Pope, the appellant, has better parenting skills than my client? Quote, when you funnel it all down, that's what I'm saying. There was one other concern that I asked her about, and that was my client's history of being a sexual abuse victim. And she was very concerned about that, testified that that was a huge concern, yet the testimony before the court was that my client did believe that her child was sexually abused in the custody of the appellant. She didn't call the police. She didn't call child protection. She didn't deny parenting time, all things that we have seen as an overreaction to this. She did none of those things. So there was no direct evidence that that was going to be a problem with my client's parenting. Matter of fact, the opposite was true. So with regard to the custody evaluation, that there are two, the court, I think I just explained why there are two with the same recommendation. It was because it was misdiagnosed the first time as a psychological condition. Ms. Midnick diagnosed it, she doesn't diagnose, she'd yell at me for using that word, but she described it the right way, that it was parenting skills. My client then immediately goes, goes and gets parenting classes. And that statement that it's not done at the same time is just not accurate in the record, and I believe that I've described it in the brief.
So your client apparently changed her position regarding custody, physical and legal, at trial or shortly before. Is that accurate?
That is not accurate, and I am not able to tell you when because I am prohibited to talk about settlement discussions, Your Honor. That has not been,
client. Well, I guess what I was getting at, and I appreciate your clarification on that, and I'm sure if Ms. Tressler disagrees, she'll address that in her rebuttal.
Well, but she really wasn't present. Let's be clear that another counsel was in trial, and another counsel is who I was dealing with. So,
what I was getting at is the suggestion was made during appellant's argument that that change was made perhaps for strategic purposes because of the presumption for if one party is requesting a joint custody situation, that then there's a presumption in that favor and it needs to be overcome. I've reviewed the order. I don't see where the court even talks about a presumption, even if that did occur. And I'm just wondering if that factored into the circumstances at all here. Was that addressed? Was that addressed before the court as to whether or not, in light of the request at trial for a joint custody order, that there was now some presumption that had come into play and the court needed to address it?
No, not to my memory. And when it happened was as soon as Mindy Mitnick's report came out and my client realized that she could hear it this time. She could hear the suggestions about her parenting, and that's why she did a coach, and that's why her position changed. But no, Your Honor, I don't see it in the order either. I don't see a deference to joint legal in the order. I see very well thought out reasons why the court believed that joint legal custody was necessary. Your Honors, with regard to the issue of that, with regard to the issue of joint legal custody and joint physical custody, there's an allegation that you are not supposed to do the analysis together. And I know the courts know that there's actually a court decision that was cited that's not reported, but states that there's nothing wrong with that. It certainly would be preferable, according to the court, but nothing's wrong. So I do want to point back to what counsel said about how you can't use the alienation with regard to physical custody, parenting time, or legal custody. And there's actually, the court is very clear, Your Honor. It's 518. This is one of the factors of both physical and legal. They're not divided in the statute. The willingness and ability of parents to cooperate in the rearing of their child to maximize sharing information and minimize exposure of the child to parental conflict, and to utilize methods resolving disputes regarding any major decision. So that's both. And that is also includes, that's talking about alienation. The example, the allegation that somehow a physical alienation does not affect my client's legal rights. In this particular situation, he used his ability to control time to affect my client's ability to be involved in her education. Now, this allegation that somehow the court incorrectly made a finding that he did it twice, once at Thanksgiving and once in Christmas, is just completely contrary to the transcript that I've included. And it's on page 11. I would like to pick her up at 5 tomorrow. Confirm you're okay with that. A little bit later, I haven't heard back from you. Please let your mom know I will be picking her up today. Let me know when this weekend you want to keep her. And then I had already expressed my intention, she's referring to telling him before, to attend Christmas breakfast with Elisa in her school tomorrow. I emailed you about it earlier this week, notifying you of my plans again. And he doesn't respond. And then the last one, I don't want, well, that's irrelevant, so you can read it, Your Honor, but it's not specifically relevant. And so what she's trying to do is to get contact at the school when he's at work. This isn't even about him wanting to have some parenting time. This is very prevalent in the brief and in the argument here. This notion that the court did not dig in to the evaluations to pull out facts that support the appellant's argument. This is what happened, Your Honor. Honors. The appellant did not present any evidence to the court in real time to illustrate the problems that he claimed happened with my client. We went through about 10 questions, you can see it in the transcript, all leading, all objected to, and then counsel just stopped asking.
Well, is part of that issue the fact that parties of the court, or, I mean, it had already been determined that the reports were going to come in as evidence?
Correct.
So, I mean, but to the extent that appellant reported information to one or both of the custody evaluators, that information is already in, and you're trying to try this case in an expeditious way, that evidence is in.
Except, Your Honor, both in the brief and here, we haven't heard what that evidence is. They haven't told you what that evidence is. It's not in the brief. It's not here. She hasn't listed it. She said she was going to. There are no facts, apparently, that I've found that somehow they say the court missed. It's not in the brief, and it wasn't listed here. But here's the problem. He had the opportunity to give real stories in real time about my client's behavior since the evaluation, since her parenting time coaching, and either it did not exist or he chose not to give it. And so it's the court's job to judge credibility. You don't want the court to accept the credibility findings of the evaluator. That's not their job. And it shouldn't be. It's the court's job to evaluate the credibility. So then there's a good example of this that's detailed, that there's supposedly my client took the child out of 2 daycares without permission. That's how it was reported in the custody evaluation, both of them. Then when I cross-examined him on the stand, it was clear that that just wasn't true. The first one, it was his idea to take the child out of the care of grandma, and he deferred to my client as to pick the daycare. So credibility matters. The whole story matters, particularly in this situation when we first think it's one thing with Judy Sherwood's report that my client has severe mental illness that will not allow her to change or learn on her behavior. And then we have a trusted custody evaluator saying, no, that's not true. This is a situation of parenting skills, and she does have the ability to change. Both of those were in there. And then we have the testimony that was presented to the court by my client and the parenting coach that convinced the court that it had actually worked. What's missing is any stories about how it hadn't worked. What's missing is about any stories about how she would not change her parenting skills. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Tressler, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very quickly, a couple things that came up on the tail end, which are in evidence. My client did agree that it was time for the child to move out of grandma's care and go to a daycare. The fact that they agreed to that has nothing to do with the fact that he had no say in the daycares. He also had no say when mom decided to voluntarily move the child to a daycare in Apple Valley. They were based in St. Paul and suddenly moved to Apple Valley. That was not co-parenting, and that was a unilateral decision. There's also this ongoing claim that my client somehow was interfering with the respondent's parenting time. The fact is there was never a schedule. There is nothing in evidence that he ever had more parenting time, and in fact, he was struggling to try to get equal parenting time after the first evaluation came out. In fact, counsel for respondent, one of her questions to Ms. Mitnick, she literally refers to it as, he was now exercising a 50-50 schedule. That's how she led the question. The very, very key thing that's being missed, why this should not be a joint legal, especially case, let alone joint physical. These two cannot communicate. It is on the record they couldn't agree about school, they couldn't agree about a schedule, they couldn't agree about diet. These two probably can't agree what color her gym shoes should be. They cannot make a decision together. And all the case law we cited, whether you're talking about Crosby, Weatherly, Wapata, they all come down to the same set of facts. The cases where they show discourse between the parents and they still give joint custody, such as Zander and I believe it's Rosenfeld, there were evaluations in both cases, in those cases, that recommended joint legal and joint physical custody, or joint legal for sure. I apologize, I can't quote the physical. But they noted that the parties had the ability to set their differences aside when it was time to make decisions for the children. We have no evidence of that here. And as far as when mom came on the record for joint legal and joint physical custody, the first time it came up on the record was at trial. So if it was negotiated, I was not. One of the other attorneys in my office was the one who tried the case. So I wasn't there at settlement negotiations. I can't speak for that. But I can speak to the fact that it was not on the record, the answer and counter petition were not amended, and all of a sudden, when we're at trial, it was joint was being requested. The evaluations were done with the fact that both parties were asking for sole legal and sole physical. And even to what counsel said, she said, best interest requires credibility and totality. Totality requires the direct evidence of those evaluations to be considered by the court, and they weren't. The findings of facts make no reference to the specific concerns of Mindy Mitnick or the specific concerns of Judy Sherwood, and never acknowledges that Judy Sherwood under oath stated that those reports by Dr. Peterson were just one piece of the puzzle. There was a tremendous amount of work that went into those evaluations. As you noted, Mindy Mitnick's, I believe, took 7 months, and I believe Judy Sherwood's took 5 to 6. So there was a lot of time involved in these.
But was there any findings that suggested the court applied a presumption in light of the change in position by respondent, Ms. Tressler?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor. Not that I can recall. I believe that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.